welcome to our Core Christi monthly discussion. My name is Rachel Pachta, and I am the Director of Ministry for the Missioners of Christ. And as always, I'm joined today by my lovely co-host, Angela Whitehouse, as well as our guest for our book study, Father Cassidy Stinson. This month, we'll chat about the final chapters in St. Mary Magdalene, Prophetess of Eucharistic Love by Father Sean Davidson. We've loved studying this book with all of you. We hope that it has been as fruitful of a study as it has been for us. We have a lot to unpack today. So without further ado, here is our fourth and final episode on St. Mary Magdalene, Prophetess of Eucharistic Love. Welcome back, everyone.
Hello. Hi, everybody.
How are you doing?
Good. Sorry, Father Cassie, I caught you off guard with pressing record.
I'm just over here checking my notes, and she's like, and we're recording. I'm like, oh. Let's go, kids.
Oh, okay. We are recording this during Holy Week. How's your Holy Week going?
Surprisingly good, actually. I was like dragging a lot last week. I think I just had like 1 hour too many of confessions to hear, but Chrism Mass last night, we just had our Chrism Mass, which, as many of you may know, it's like this really beautiful celebration of the priesthood, I think fundamentally is what it is. It's a time where most of the priests in the diocese come together with the bishop to renew our priestly promises. And for me, it was really the first normal, quote unquote, Chrism Mass I've been to since getting ordained as a priest. And it was just a really beautiful moment of communion with my brother priest, with the bishops. And it was just really, really renewing in many ways. So I'm starting Holy Week surprisingly strong. I thought I'd be half dead, but I'm feeling great.
That's awesome. That is awesome. I've always wanted to go to Chrism Mass. I've never been before.
Oh, you got to go.
I feel like the first time I thought, I'd like to do that was during COVID, because I was super hyper aware of all the liturgies going on because they're all televised. And I don't know if maybe it didn't happen during the COVID like quarantine years or what it was, but I thought, oh, I really want to go. And then, you know, I haven't been able to, so it's on the bucket list.
You can go to our ordinations though. We have three.
I am due to have my baby that weekend.
You might be busy.
Might have something going on.
wait, which weekend? Because we changed the schedule.
Oh, May 22nd is my due date.
You have like a whole month to get over the baby. Like,
what?
Before. Yeah.
So I thought that the diaconate ordinations were May 21st. Is it no longer?
That's still the case. But the priesthood ordination, the first one, we have two, is going to be at the end of June.
Seriously?
Okay, get Rach. Right.
Bring the baby. It will be awesome.
Awesome. This is excellent. This
Happy
is
Holy
excellent
Week.
News. Thank yeah. you. It was a wow, little gift, a gift to me, Father Cassidy. Angela, we should go.
That would be so fun. I'd love that.
Let's take a field trip.
Yeah.
Or Christy meetup.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. That would be so fun. I have been to an ordination. I have been to a Chrism Mass, and I love it. It's one of my favorites. I love when they're doing the sacred chrism, and they like are mixing like all of the things that go into it, and then he breathes into it. Like the breath of the Holy Spirit. It's so cool. Like the visuals are so
super
powerful.
Tangible. Yeah, yeah. It's like this great moment of like the bishop is like stirring things and mixing things.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it looks like he's just like stirring and
like taking a big jug of one thing and putting it into another three jugs of another thing.
It's amazing. It's so great.
I have chrism oil that's blessed. That's just like chrism oil someone bought, and then it's a priest blessed it. But it's not like the chrism oil.
Uh-oh, you're getting a skeptical look from Father Cassidy.
It's not legit, like, chrism sacramental oil, right?
Like, what you gonna do with it?
Well, do a little sign of the cross.
With fake chrism?
But it's blessed.
I think you just call that blessed oil,
Blessed oil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Should I not have it in my house?
I don't care.
It's not like...
It's fine.
Anathema or whatever. Like,
I mean, there's probably some tradition for it somewhere. I just didn't know anything about it.
Well, a really great family gave it to us, and I was like, what a cool idea. And but I love just smelling it because it smells like church.
Meditate on your confirmation, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like baptisms. Isn't chrism oil used at baptisms?
Yep. It's one of my favorite parts of the baptism is my hands smell good for like a day afterward.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, like, oh, baby smell.
This is an unintentional lead-in to like Saint Mary Magdalene, who is like the anointer of the New Testament and consoler of Jesus. So we're on chapters 6 and 7 today. And the first chapter of that pair, the first consoler of Jesus and Mary. And I'm just going to, I'm going to pull my very favorite kind of intro quote from page 157. And it says, however, while still at table, and before the light of the evening was engulfed by the darkness of Gethsemane, the thought of Jesus was not for himself, but rather to console the hearts of his brothers. Let not your hearts be troubled. As a good father who must soon leave his children to depart for war gently prepares their little hearts for separation with words of love, so it was with Jesus before the warfare of the Passion. I love that. The tenderness of his heart, which I think comes out in this chapter, this meditation that he has so much, is the tenderness of Jesus' heart throughout his passion that is all done for others.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really a beautiful image to see the Eucharist in that way, right? It says it's his last will and testament, right? And that's some of the language, I think, in terms of like the language that's actually used in this is like he's very explicitly making it a last testament, right, to his disciples. But it's also, I think, to us, right? It's that gift that's been handed down, right? I think much as Leah, you know, it has that sort of, I mean, I know we know it's a gift, right? But it's something that we're grateful for. But it has also that sort of personal touch, much as like a family heirloom does.
I mean, do you guys want to talk a little bit about, so I'm looking here on 158, going off of that idea that this is his last will and testament, and his nourishment for his apostles. It says, even while the apostles' lips were still purpled by the divine sap of his Eucharistic blood, Jesus explained how he could love through their hearts so that they would truly be able to love as he loved them and one day bear much fruit. And then he does say, however, the happy memory of this outpouring of sacramental grace and divine love was soon to be mingled with tears and regrets for the apostles. It's such a, you know, it's such a paradox because they go from this like height of like first reception of Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. And within 24 hours, they have all betrayed and deserted him. In one way or the other, right? Except for, you know, St. John, I suppose. And, but of the others, like in one way or another, they have betrayed and deserted him. And I guess it's something that, you know, just to ponder ourselves is like, it's just a lesson in what is that? Like a lesson in our frailty and in divine mercy.
I've thought a lot about that particular point, actually, during this Lent. A lot of my meditation during this Lent has been on the priesthood and, like, in a particular way, on some of the individual apostles and their responses to the Passion. And one of the thoughts, or really the thoughts I've been unpacking, has been courtesy of Fulton Sheen. I revisited a couple of his books on the priesthood, one of which I think a lot of people read. It's kind of like the classic, you know, you go to seminary and you read this book, is The Priest Is Not His Own. And it's a really great meditation on the priesthood. I read it in seminary, but I hadn't read since getting ordained. And the other, it was his autobiography, which is Treasures in Clay, I believe is the name. Both of which are excellent. I think his autobiography is massively underrated. Highly recommend. But to get back to the point, he gets at something really fundamental about like why, I think why Judas in particular betrays him, right? Judas, I was struck this morning, we're recording this on Tuesday of Holy Week. Our readings in the morning were about Judas leaving in the middle of the Eucharistic banquet, right? He leaves like right in the midst of that great sacrament of unity, like the conferral of the, you know, the great unifying force of love in the church. That is when Judas betrays him, right? Or like really like finally leaves communion, breaks communion with Christ. And it's something to that, right? He didn't just do that on a whim. It was a lot of small infidelities that led up to him becoming unable to see Christ for who he was and what Christ wanted to do for him, right? Which is, I think that's, it's a warning story in so many ways to us, right? That's how relationships fall apart. It's how our relationship with Christ falls apart, not usually in one fell swoop. It's like, you know, it's usually a lot of small cracks in the foundation over a period of time.
Yeah, I was thinking about that a lot too. Honestly, our conversation that we had in our last podcast about the contrast between Mary Magdalene and Judas, and how you were saying, Father, like how it was over the course of these little things where he thought that he, you know, perceived Christ a certain way and he was not. And it was kind of these small things that had been working. And then to this climax of leaving during the, you know, this, the Eucharistic banquet. And I was kind of reflecting a little bit about, like you were saying, Rachel, the kind of the how fragile the spiritual life can be, how we can be that, you know, we can be acting like Judas in some ways and then acting as Mary the adorer in other ways, and how the Lord just like continually is speaking, especially to me throughout this Lent, is just that single-heartedness to the Lord, that consistent faithfulness to him, even amidst those small things, those small betrayals. We see too, like the contrast of like the other apostles who fell asleep, or Peter who betrayed Jesus, and how it wasn't like a severing of the relationship. It was like, I really messed up. But the difference of those relationships and then of Judas was that they then like went back to the Lord and asked for his mercy. Like they had constantly gone back and wanted to still be with him, even though they had messed up. But yeah, I like the idea of just kind of reflecting upon how they could be at the Eucharistic table for 1 minute, and then the next they had gone through this like these hardships and this pain, and that's when like they had denied him and betrayed him and all of those things. But just how the Lord always calls us back to be single-heartedly for him.
Yeah, there's this tension. I was struck when I think it was in this chapter, I can't pinpoint the exact part, I was just looking as you said that, Angela, because it reminded me of this, I don't know, lesson I feel like the Lord continues to point out to me, is that I cannot earn my salvation. Mm-hmm. It's the mystery of nature and grace, like how our will interacts with grace. And it's not that we're like automatons, like we're just going to either like Calvinistic, like we're just going to totally be saved or not, dependent on what God decides. But at the same time, it's not like we're working for it. I guess what I'm trying to articulate, you know what I mean? This is like a long discussion in the history of the church.
Oh yeah.
How nature and grace interact with each other.
I mean, this is like getting right back to like St. Augustine and Pelagius and everyone, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Right, it's a real temptation to think that we have to do the work of our salvation. Like the irony is, you know, we do it usually out of, at least in part, a sort of distrust that God will, you know, be willing to just give us that gift in his generosity. Right, I think we don't feel like we can trust him to be that generous, that radically willing to give us that gift.
I think the thing that we see in the difference between Judas and the apostles, he does something so heinous. Like when I didn't realize like even the language behind the kiss, the emphatic kiss, you know, and the lengths to which he went to just be nasty. I don't know how else to put it. Like just be really nasty through the whole thing. But then also that he it was followed up with despair. And ultimately ending his own life. And the thought was like, I don't know, like for the apostles and with St. Mary Magdalene, who lived this out so beautifully. And then also we see with the apostles after the resurrection is this, they just return to the one they love, even though they've hurt him and they've betrayed him. They go back to the one they love because in their heart they love him. They didn't understand. They were scared. All of their human frailty came to the forefront even after receiving the like bomb of graces from, you know, receiving the Blessed Sacrament and being initiated or like was ordained as priest, you know, by Jesus. All of their humanity comes out, but they return to the one they loved. And Judas did not return to the one he loved because he did not love him. And maybe that's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I think that boils down to like to two with, I don't know, struggling over that kind of prideful notion of like, well, look at all the good things I've done, Lord. Like the older son, you know, like, look at all the good things I've done. And I have not betrayed you. And I have not, you know, I've been the good kid. I've been the good kid. And I want my reward for being the good kid versus like the one who just kind of runs back to the father in the midst of frailty because he's returning to the one who he's come to love and realize that he's come to love him.
Right. Well, let's think about Peter, right? Peter is, I think, the great archetype in the story of, you know, the story of the passion and the resurrection of one who desires to follow Christ and then fails and then is redeemed, right? He returns to the Lord's mercy at the end of the gospel after the resurrection. Mm-hmm. And it's a great and a really beautiful model for how the Lord uses these failings in our life, right? When we do bring them to his mercy, when we don't despair and we actually, you know, get up and return to him and profess our love again, the Lord actually uses that to take us beyond where we had been before we fell. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't just return to where we started, we return a step higher, right? Think about how Peter's apostolic ministry after that point would be shaped by the radical mercy he experienced, right? We see the fruit of that in the fact that he did go and become a great martyr, right, in Rome and the church, right? Right where St. Peter's is built now, you know, he's still there. You see the fruit of that transformative experience of mercy, right? Much as the same way as Mary Magdalene remained faithful at the foot of the cross because she had already experienced that.
Yeah.
She had full and a very deep knowledge, right? Deeper than pretty much anyone save the Blessed Mother herself of just how deep Christ's love went. And so she already had that incredible apostolic zeal, right? It was manifested differently than in the lives of the rest of the apostles, the disciples, but you know, she had that love because she understood the depth of the mercy and the fact that he wasn't going to just turn someone away because of sin alone, right? It would, he only lets us go if we want it.
Yeah. The other part of this chapter that stood out to me was when they were talking about the Christ in the agony in the garden and how he was, something that struck me was just how it says on page 163, but on the one night that Jesus Christ truly needed his friends, their love was not strong enough to accompany him to the bitter end. And I was just thinking we often think of Christ's humanity needing things, but to say like Christ needed his friends as like comforters. And I guess, and then the author kind of goes on to say how if Mary Magdalene had been there, she would have no doubt, like she had that passionate love for Christ, she would have no doubt been the comforter to him. But I think the idea of comforting Christ and consoling him is one that took me a while to really understand and to kind of like adjust the mindset that I need to be a comforter to Jesus Christ. And I don't know if you all have kind of had that same experience or have thoughts on that, but it kind of just struck me in the reading, and I kind of want to hear like if you guys have, it just kind of threw me, that doesn't throw me off, it's just kind of like, this is a huge concept that we actually can console him.
It's a mysterious thing because it requires us to appreciate the sort of outside of time dimension of our life of prayer, right? In a sort of temporal sense, I think it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Yeah. But in the order of grace, it makes a lot of sense, right? And in fact, it's an incredibly beautiful dimension of the prayer life of the church, right? Especially, right, we see many of the saints. That there are so many saints who, especially in the contemplative life of the church, have been invited into that particular focus on the consolation of the heart of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you know, I go back a lot to St. Faustina's meditation on
Bingo.
Holy Week. Bingo!
St. Faustina.
She, I mean, that was the first time that reading her diary was the first time it really clicked for me, the concept of what consoling the heart of Jesus actually is. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, let me back that up. It was reading the book Consoling the Heart of Jesus by Father Michael Gately, and then mm-hmm. after that, it springboarded me into wanting to read her diary. And it was it like actually hearing her firsthand account of Jesus expressing to her which of her actions and prayers were consoling, that like when she wanted to accompany him during like Holy Thursday, Good Friday, like partake in his sufferings with him so that he could be consoled, and to bring him like the number one thing that was always so consoling to him was bringing more souls to him for him to have mercy on them. He was just burning in his heart to have mercy on more and more souls. And so her willingness to pray for them and to love them and to bring them to the Lord more and more, that was always so consoling to him. And so it is a huge mystery, and I feel like it's something that a contemplative heart like St. Mary Magdalene's gets, because it takes a quietness, like you were talking, Father Cassie, about, like particularly in the contemplative life of the church, because it's a really personal encounter with the person of Jesus. It's not like an idea or like a certain amount of novenas or actions that we can accomplish. It's like it's a relational exchange between him and the individual.
Yeah, it will not make sense.
Yeah.
If you don't spend like a really substantial amount of time in silent prayer and like in front of the Eucharist, like this is just going to sound like insanity otherwise. You know, it's something that really only makes sense on an experiential level, frankly.
Yeah. And there's a dialogue of the soul with God that is particular. So it's like we can't like even really define it like we could when we're just talking about like the interchange of nature and grace or whatever. You know, there's things like, but there's no synod on consoling the heart of Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. Because no, I mean, maybe not, Father Cassie, what am I trying to say? There's no like what are they called? What are those things called that are, they define doctrine?
Dogma?
You know what I mean?
Like an encyclical or like
No, because there probably is an encyclical on it. Oh my gosh.
Like a council or something.
Yeah.
Apostolic
how to dialogue with Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. Like there's not, because you can't define it because it is personal. It's so personal.
I think as I was kind of reflecting on that, I think it's almost like how each of my three kids, when they get hurt, they each require a different way in which they like to be comforted. And it's kind of like, it is such a personal thing with the Lord, where it's like my heart specifically can comfort him in only a certain way. Whereas like Rachel and Father Cassidy, like you all comfort the Lord and can console him differently.
Yeah.
And it's such an individual thing of how we can bring that. I like the image of almost like that balming or that anointing as Mary Magdalene did, and how we can bring that to the Lord too.
Yeah. And I think one of the temptations is that we sleep through, as it were, right, as the apostles did, you know, the opportunity to console the heart of Christ. I think it's something, because it is not something in which we are, you know, bound by any obligation externally to do. Right, I think it's something that can easily be missed as an opportunity, an invitation from Christ, right? Like, nobody's going to tell you, like, you know, you need to pray X number of holy hours to fulfill this obligation to console Christ. Like, that's not the nature of the relationship, right? You know, you don't tell a married person, right, you need to do X, Y, and Z, right, to love your spouse, right? You just love them, and you love them in the way that is unique to you and to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. You can't quantify it.
Right.
Yeah. And love them within the context of life, of where life is at the moment. You know, like the thought that just crossed my mind was Father Cassidy's, like, Jesus isn't asking me to love him as a Catholic priest, right? Because I'm not a Catholic priest. He literally designed me in a way in which I could not become a Catholic priest. But I am a wife and mother, a woman. Like, there is a particular way in which I, in my portion, my little tiny place in the body of Christ, am needed by him, in which he desires for me to be there, just like there is for the Carmelite nun who's cloistered. Like there's a difference in these states, but it's all part of one body.
It made me think, too, like the uniqueness of our love for the Lord, how, Father, you were talking about the how when the apostles were asleep and how we oftentimes miss the opportunity, like we're quote unquote asleep in our spiritual life or in consoling the Lord. But one thing that he says as an example of this in regards to Holy Communion was he was like, the author on page 166, how many Catholics arise from bended knee and approach the altar of Holy Communion with amen on their lips, but unbelief in their hearts. And that contrast of like, yes, we say amen with our mouths. And he's comparing this to the kiss of Judas too, but the contrast between these things of what is in our heart versus what is on our lips, what is being lived out versus how are we being transformed inside, what are we on a physical level, what are we saying or doing in our spiritual life, you know, this many holy hours or this attending mass, and then but inside we're, you know, a complete mess and we're not really bringing things to the Lord. And so just like that call to inner transformation within ourselves as well.
And I think the thing that's challenging about this to people is they might hear that and say, like, what do I do? And I can't give them a straight answer. Like, some confessions are like that. It's like, you need to go deeper, right? You need, like, Jesus needs to help you unpack this thing. Like, I'm at a point where I can't do that for you. I can't give you a prescription and say, like, if you pray this thing this many times a week, it'll fix it. Like, I can't be, like, I can point you to Jesus. I can give you his mercy in the sacrament, right? But eventually you guys need to talk about this, mm-hmm. right? I don't know. Like, I guess it's, like, analogous to, like a marriage counseling situation or something like that. Like, I can tell you some suggestions, but eventually you two need to talk this out.
The line in The Chosen, yeah, I was convicted. I've been just convicted about, like, times of silence that I have and, continuing, this has been an ongoing conviction I brought up so many times, I feel like on the podcast a lot during this book study, but the conviction of not being so much of a busybody, but just really taking time of quiet to be in prayer and to talk with the Lord. And my husband and I at night have been watching The Chosen again, the second season, or maybe the first season. I can't even remember which episode comes from what at this point, but there was one, oh yes, it was my favorite episode, which is the one on the calling of Nathaniel, who our child will be named after. For this actual story. Yay. And he says to Philip, because it's Philip who brings Nathaniel to Jesus. And so Philip says, can we stop in this? Is it okay if I like stop here in this town to go see my friend? And he says, Jesus says to him, yes, because if we don't spend time with our friends, we won't have any friends. And it was just like this side comment, but for me, it struck me in my heart of, yeah, like, and if I don't spend time with Jesus, I'm going to walk away from that friendship, you know, the intimacy of that friendship. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's a vulnerability too. Like you were talking about, Father Cassie, like at some point you guys need to talk about this, like, in friendship, a true friendship and love. And Father Davidson talks about this is a friendship that has vulnerability as part of it to share hearts with each other. So
to run with the analogy a little bit, you know, when it comes to, I think like much in the same way that a marriage, you know, like as the marriage becomes healthier, it gives life, right? And brings, you know, the healthiness of a marriage, right? The people who are in that sphere, right? Children, friends of the family, whatever, right? They all benefit from the fruitfulness of that relationship, mm-hmm. right? There is a live dimension to the call to reparation now in the church, right? Which he gets into, right? I think it's page 176, 177. He just says outright, he says, what the church needs today above all, if we're going to make up for the unceasing torrent of sacrileges and outrages that flood the sanctuary, are souls who know how to gaze like Magdalene into the eyes of Eucharistic Jesus, right? If you believe that Jesus is present in the Blessed Sacrament, right? We need to act like it, not just for ourselves, but for everyone else. Yeah. Right? There's this apostolic dimension, right? Just as Mary Magdalene had a prophetic dimension to her vocation, where she was bearing witness to others, right? Her love would have been beautiful if it was just for her and Jesus, but it's not. It's for everyone else too, right? Yeah. Same thing for us. Our love has to, I think, if it's authentic, bear fruit, right? In a way that goes outside of ourselves.
Yes.
In chapter 7, perfect segue to Apostle to the Apostles, is that her love, which he talks about how it's like Jesus just wanted to give her this blessed friend of his, a particular consolation after his resurrection, because she was so shattered by it, so saddened. But it's out of the intimacy of their souls together that comes her apostolic mission to the apostles, like to go proclaim his resurrection to the apostles. And it was the one who loved him so much who went, because it was the fruit of that love. And again, I love that Father Davidson, he mentions that, you know, all throughout the Gospels, Mary Magdalene does something, people criticize her. She does something, people criticize her. And he was like, she goes to the apostles to tell them she has seen the Lord, and no one believes her. Mm-hmm. But she's, I just love this woman, because she's so like, I don't care what you think. Like, but the only desire of my heart and the fixation of my heart is the Lord. And that is the one who he has called to be the one to proclaim, the very first to proclaim him.
And it's very telling, as he points out, that she is the one who has the most ardent love, right, and to whom he reveals himself first. You know, there's this recurring trend, especially in John's gospel, of how those who are closest to the heart of Christ are the first to know what's going on, right, in terms of, you know, the mysteries of what's unfolding, and they're the ones who hear the most, or see the most, right? So John the Apostle is, right, the other big model of this, right? We heard, again, today's gospel, he's the one who Peter says, like, hey, ask Jesus about what he's talking about when he says who's going to betray him, right? Because John is, right, literally and, you know, more in a spiritual sense, also sort of metaphorically, he's the one who's resting on the heart of Christ. He knows Christ's heart the most intimately. Mm-hmm. I like to think a lot about the parallels between John and Mary Magdalene, partly because actually of Father Sean. When I went on retreat with him, they had two relics that were up on the altar, like right in front of me the whole week. One was John the Apostle, and the other was Mary Magdalene.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I was like, the parallels are obvious and also physical right now. This is great.
Yeah, like, this is amazing. They're before Jesus in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a beautiful witness to that, right? Because as he says, I think page 183, she's a witness to the fact that sin and, like, even a life of sin or a significant part of our lives lived away from Christ, that has no bearing on whether or not you can have an intimate friendship with him. Like, that will not stop you, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't let it.
Yeah.
I was thinking about how he was talking about when in the gospel, when Christ said her name, she recognized him, she knew him. And it was just the simple, like, knowing, talking about it, the intimacy in their relationship, just knowing how he says her name was enough to say, like, oh my gosh, this is you, Lord. And it wasn't just like, this is you. It was like, this is the truth of the resurrection before me. Like, in just hearing her name, the truth of everything, of who Jesus was and what he had come for and salvation was all laid out in that moment for her. And I don't know. I've just kind of been reflecting on that a little bit of, Lord, if you call my name, will I know your voice? Like, if you say my name, like, will I know? Are we that close? Like, are we that close, Lord, that I would be able to call you out and you call me out and we are right there with each other? And so it just kind of made me think about that, especially preparing for Easter. Since we are in Holy Week, and just thinking about, you have called me by name, Lord, like he has already called us by name and we are his, but really living into that truth of who the Lord says that we are. And so I've just kind of been thinking about that a bit, getting ready for Easter.
One of the, I think, most striking things that he points out is just how much the experience of the resurrection for Mary Magdalene was something that exceeded even her greatest desire for his presence, right? And I got really fired up by that, because I've just seen that so many times in my own life. And it's something that I think is so critical to understanding the deepening of our vocation and the course of our life and the way in which God calls us to give things up, right? There's a sacrificial dimension to our vocation always, right? Just because that's, right, what it means to follow in Christ's steps on the way of the cross, right? We give things up. We offer things as sacrifice, and they're taken up and they're transformed, right? And in that, the thing that keeps you anchored to Christ is this trust that he is going to fulfill your desire. Right, this faith or, you know, hope in a really powerful way that he will bring you happiness, right? Not just happiness in a superficial way, but happiness in a way that fulfills even our deepest desires, much of which we often don't understand, like what we want or how much we want it. And then he not only meets that in the way that we desire and the way we think we do, in ways we don't even realize. And then he takes it to another level. He's radically generous. And that's why such a big piece of that struggle for so many people is just getting to the point in your relationship with the Lord where he can prove that to you. At some point, you do have to jump out on some kind of leap of faith and let him prove to you that he actually wants you to be happy and joyful, right? Then he'll show you, right? But you often have to be, right? You know, like Mary Magdalene was running out on her own in the dark, risking her life in some ways, right, to go and find just Christ's body. And she finds so much more than that, right? There's this sort of leap of faith where you have to go out into the night, you know, sort of a, you know, a Song of Songs, you know, seeking for the beloved.
Yeah. There's a relinquishing of control, because I think at the heart of control, at least for me and in my experience, is not wanting to be let down, so therefore I will control. Therefore I will blah, 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 do. But it's the relinquishing of control and a recognition that I am in a relationship with another who is greater than I. Even on small-scale desires, like, for example, there's a project that I can't particularly talk about yet that we're working on with missionaries, but it's been a desire of my heart for like over a year. And I had gotten to the point where I was like, I am about to have a baby in 6 weeks. I have literally no idea how this is going to come to be. And then like a grant we applied for a year ago comes in, and the two key people to make the project happen reached out to me without knowing the grant had come in, saying, "What do you think about this happening?" And so, I mean, you know, but that, it was, in my heart, there was like a, like, Jesus, you handle all of these things. I was feeling this pressure. You know, like, I just want this to happen for you. Like, that's where the desire started. Mm-hmm. But you also see that I'm incapable of doing this on my own. And so he completely provided for everything and is providing for it to happen. And so I couldn't help but today, because today a couple things came together with that. And I thought, let me just sit back for a second and feel really like provided for and loved by the Lord right now and be mindful of this, because this is not coincidental.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the great tragedies is when we take for granted some of those blessings, right? Or don't realize that they're coming from Christ. It's sort of an act of, it's certainly an act of pride, and it's probably something worse, right? When we think that, you know, we've earned the things for ourselves that are really just gifts of the generous heart of Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to be grateful, and I think you have to be intentional about cultivating that gratitude.
I was thinking about the question that Christ asked the apostles when he calls them, and he says, "What do you seek?" And then later, after the resurrection, when he sees Mary Magdalene, and Father Sean was talking about, he asked her the question, "Whom do you seek?" Mm-hmm. And in those situations in our lives where we don't really, sometimes when it's like we want to have control of a situation, we want to know what the outcome is, we're seeking kind of like the thing. We're seeking like I'm entrusting this to you, Lord, but I'm also wanting to know like the outcome or what's going to happen, or that element of control that you were talking about, Rachel. But then when we shift our question into saying, "Whom do you seek?" that immediately changes into a deeper relationship with the Lord, where we're now looking at, "Lord, I desire these things, but I desire them within the context of our relationship," which is then a whom. It's a person. And so now it's not so much, what are the things that I'm seeking after? But really, Lord, I'm just desiring you alone. And from desiring you, you are going to take these things, transform these things, and then make my desire into something that is a reality. Mm. When we've like switched into this mindset of like, who is it that we are seeking? And ultimately, it is the Lord. And I think, you know, we've seen that throughout our lives, like in moments of conversion or in moments of like, I don't know where I am right now or what's going on, Lord, but I am constantly seeking you. Like, you are the whom in which I am seeking. It is a person. And so I don't know. I was reflecting on that a lot too. When those moments happen and the Lord fulfills the desire of our heart after we have surrendered and just sought him.
That's something that happens really over the course of our entire spiritual lives, is the Lord just progressively purifies what that love is, right? Because we see, I think, imperfections, little ways in which, you know, not everything that we do in our spiritual life in the beginning is purely selfless, right? Because we don't know what we're seeking in some ways, right?
Yeah.
Kind of like the apostles, you know, they're like, this really compelling guy just told me to follow him, but like, we don't know who he is. We kind of don't really have a good grasp on like what his message is yet, right? But like, we're going to tag along, right? See what's going on. And over time it deepens, right? It gets purified. Our love for Christ gets purified. You know, we love prayer in the beginning because of the peace that it gives us. And eventually we come to love prayer regardless of what it gives us, just because it's time with Christ, right? That's a fundamental purification of the interior life. You could say that about anything. It's like, you know, we love, you know, apostolic work because of, you know, part of us likes attention. Part of us wants to authentically like make people happy, and we want other people to be happy. And part of us does authentically love the Lord and want to give love to the Lord, right? It's not bad to take pleasure in things that are good unto themselves that are part of that. But the question of why you're doing it, what you're seeking, who you're seeking, that has to be clarified and purified. And it's really the Lord's work. Like, it's not something we can do for ourselves, ultimately. It's the Lord looking at us more than us looking at the Lord that really starts to, you know, create that conversion.
And I think that that's the key to the point of this book, the point of a meditation on St. Mary Magdalene, is exactly what you said, Father Cassidy. It's the beginning of like, well, I'm doing this because it makes me feel good. We see that in the beginning of the book, St. Mary Magdalene is drawn to the Lord because he's the only place, the only one with whom she has found peace and release. And it quickly is purified into, I just want to be with you. Mm-hmm. I'm just happy to be with you. And if that means I'm following you through your passion in a very no good feelings happening here right now, to then the overwhelming joy of the resurrection, whatever it is that you bring me, Lord, my heart is fixed entirely on you.
And at some point, I think this is something where it hits a turning point, because for everyone, right? Because not everyone, I think very few people really grow up with like a really powerful conviction of Christ's presence, like in, you know, the sacraments, for example. Like, it's something that has to crystallize at a certain point in your life, usually. I mean, I think if you have like a really, really holy family, like the kids might grow into it, you know, God willing. You see some witnesses to that. But usually there's kind of a wake-up call, right? I had that happen. I grew up in a very solidly Christian and then Catholic family. And I still had to get whacked over the head by Christ saying, like, look, I'm actually present in the sacraments. Look at me, you know, like that Eucharistic shock or Eucharistic amazement that he talks about, page 189. I was like, oh, yeah, like, I've been there. you know, that second look, that interior turn that he's talking about, that is a real thing. And, you know, if it's happened to you, you know what I'm talking about. Like, there are moments where the Lord in a very surprising way makes his presence known. And everyone has to figure, like, come to that point of awareness somehow, whether it's dramatic or not. But that is something fundamental to our interior life, right? And the point of, you know, purification and, you know, the reasons of why we are with Christ change. You know, not everyone who goes to our church goes to Mass on a Sunday is there because they know and have a firm conviction that Christ is present in the Eucharist. I wish that was the case, but it's not, you know? A lot of people are there and for more marginal reasons. And sometimes that's what draws them there, and that's not entirely a bad thing, right? You know, the humanity of the church should be attractive it should be something that is good and beautiful and purified by the love of God to draw people to the one to whom that love points, right, which is the Lord. But ultimately, right, the humanity can't suffice to meet those desires, right? Mm-hmm. Only Christ can suffice to meet those desires. Only Christ can give himself. And so that's where that interior transformation has to happen. You know, and I think eventually we can point someone to that, but Christ has to do the work. He has to be the one to ultimately make that transformation happen. So sometimes the best work you can do to convert a heart is to like just put someone in front of Jesus for a while and let them talk about it.
Mm-hmm. I heard one time that it's like a lot of people, especially in like our age bracket, have had conversions at a Steubenville conference. And I heard somebody say like, but usually what you hear is people had a profound conversion experience or vocational call experience in front of the Blessed Sacrament at a Steubenville conference. It's usually not like in a talk. I actually can't even think of a time when I've heard of a profound conversion happening in the midst of a talk. It's always seems to be happening in front of Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't devalue that preaching or that apostolic work, right? It like those are, it's a foundation for that encounter to happen, right? It's like, you know, it's like the story about Nathaniel, right? You know, he didn't, you know, just because like the friend brings him to Christ, like the friend didn't do the converting. Christ does the converting. Christ does the calling. But sometimes you need a friend to bring you to Christ.
To bring you. Exactly. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a good place to wrap up. I think we've hit our time limit. Great. And I think that, you know, thinking about needing a friend to bring us to Christ, we all need a St. Mary Magdalene who's praying for us. And we can be that friend to others too. And man, thanks so much, Father Cassidy, for joining us for this book.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
This is like a really fruitful Lent for me, I think, because of this study. So thank you.
I've been drawing on this so much in the last month or so, like in confessions and just stuff. I'm like, you all need to sit in front of the tabernacle and pray.
Yeah, that's
awesome. I've been banging on a lot about the importance of contemplative prayer. Awesome. It's been good.
So good.
So good. So we'll be praying for you, and we hope that we hear from you again in Corpus Christi at some point.
Hey, we can make it happen. Just send the invite.
Make it happen. Yes.
You have my email.
I have your email. I have your phone number. And we have a fun book study that's coming up next. Angela, do you want to tell them about it?
What you going to read?
Sure. So we're going to be doing a summer session on Father Jacques Philippe's Searching for and Maintaining Peace. And so it's a small one. It's only probably 8 chapters, but we are going to be doing that for our summer. So June, July, and August. So stay tuned. While Rachel's on maternity leave, I'll be in charge. Woo!
Yay! And the much-loved Kate Harmeyer will be making a return. Yes. And they're just going to be like the dynamic duo this summer. Yes. With Searching for and Maintaining Peace. I'm so excited. I was thinking today as I finished reading today, because I always read like right before the podcast. And as I finished the last page of this, I thought, man, that was really good. And I'm really excited to read the book that we're going to do this summer, because it'll be a time of like quiet for me.
Yeah.
Like, not as much activity and more just like, you know, physically and spiritually resting and having a baby and all those things.
And baby cuddling.
Baby snuggles.
Good life.
Yeah.
Sounds amazing.
All right. Well, thank you all so much. And until next time.
Alrighty. Bye.
Thanks.